Welcome to Northwestern Intersections, a Northwestern Network podcast where we talk to alumni about their careers. We'll hear what they've done right, what they've done wrong, and the stories behind both. My name is Cassie Potosky, and today we're talking with Emily Clear. Emily is the Director of Couple Services and part of the Clinical Services Leadership Team at the Family Institute. Through research, education, and clinical services, the Family Institute at Northwestern University is one of the nation's leading relationship-based behavioral health organizations committed to strengthening and healing children and adolescents, couples, families, and individuals. So, Emily, we're so excited to talk to you today. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm really excited to talk to you guys and to share kind of my story with other Northwestern grads.
Definitely. And I know that this is a career-focused podcast, and we're really excited to talk about all the really cool things you're doing at the Family Institute now. But before we get into that, I'd like to hear about what you did for your first job, and that can be however you interpret that.
Sure. Well, I mean, technically my first job was at Hallmark, so I don't think that's a job we want to explore stocking cards and putting gift little thingies, knickknacks out. But my first post-college job, I guess I could also share my internship because it was pretty interesting. But My first real job was with Coca-Cola. I always joke that I sold Coke.
And now you're a therapist.
Look at that. Exactly, the whole circle. So I sold fountain soda out in the Bay Area in San Francisco. So I'd go to various restaurants. I had the local entry-level position with it. So I was going to all the local restaurants, which was really kind of cool because you got to meet a lot of chefs and small business owners. So it was a really neat experience, although I was not very good at sales. So when you're selling Coke, it's easy. But, yeah, you know, later jobs, I was like, this is not the pathway for me. I knew I liked working with people, but I just didn't know how to translate that into something different.
Mm-hmm. And how long were you selling Coca-Cola in the Bay Area?
I was there for about a year, and I left not because of the job. I kind of was homesick. I loved San Francisco, and I still love to visit, but living there, I'm not a West Coast person. Mm-hmm. Like, if I'm going to pay that much in rent, then I'd rather live in New York City. I'm not beachy. I wasn't going to surf, none of that stuff. And the weather, I honestly, like, I'd rather take Chicago weather where we have very distinct seasons than this always 60-ish weather, which I'm sure people in California are like, oh.
You're crazy.
You're crazy, exactly.
That is funny. I don't hear people often saying that I live in the Midwest for the weather, but I get what you're saying, the seasons.
Yeah.
You need the season.
Yeah. It's not the Midwest weather. It's just, you know, seasons.
Yes, totally. And so you're from the Midwest. Is that right?
I'm from all over, actually. So I was born in Cincinnati. My dad worked for Dow Chemical for a majority of his career. So we went to Midland, their headquarters. Then we went to Atlanta, Georgia, and then back to Midland. And then my family moved to the Chicagoland area right after I graduated high school. So kind of all over.
How do you think that all the moving and the change throughout your childhood has impacted your mindset, I guess, and career path in general?
It's kind of impacted both. I'm a middle child, so I'm very gregarious. So I think it made me even more of a people person just because every time we moved, I'd have to acclimate to a new school system and a new kind of way of being. And there was a very stark difference coming from a Michigan school system to Atlanta and then going back from Atlanta to Michigan. So just kind of navigating cultural changes that I don't think a lot of people think about going south to north and north to south. But I think overall, it also made me a lot more flexible. So I was able to, even with job transitions, I'm able to tolerate a lot of movement and chaos. And as a therapist, it also helps me step back and think through people's experiences differently too.
Speaking of transitions, when you moved back, were you still in sales or was that when you made a career change?
Nope, I was still in sales. So I went on to work for the local CBS station and our station here in Chicago is owned by Viacom. So I went from one major corporation to another major corporation. I worked at CBS during 9/11. So it was really interesting having access to a newsroom as 9/11 was unfolding and happening and having a lot of friends. I went to the University of Michigan for undergrad, so a lot of my friends were newly in finance in New York, and this was pre-social media, so we were all kind of on AOL Instant Messenger trying to figure out, was everyone okay? Because a lot of people were down in like that part of Manhattan. So it was kind of a really cool experience being at CBS during that period in American history.
Yeah.
But again, I really sunk at sales. So even there, I knew like, oh, I'm not very good at this. So it was around that time that I started to recognize something needs to change.
Yeah. And we talk to a lot of alumni who are thinking about career changes. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder if you can think back of like how you felt in that time and how you knew that you had to make a change.
Yeah. So I have an undergrad degree in psychology and history, and both of those degrees didn't seem at the time to me like I could do anything with them. I hadn't really tracked the way I should have in psychology if I wanted to go on to graduate degrees when I was at Michigan. Mm-hmm. So I kind of started playing around. Do I need to be doing something different in business, or what does it all mean? I think since I was about 15, 16, I've always had thought about being a therapist, but I didn't know what that would look like. And when I didn't properly take that path at Michigan, I thought I had closed a door. So early in my business career, I just tried to keep turning directions. So I ended up in corporate retail / store management, merchandising, and I thought that would be enough. And I was much more successful. I worked for Neiman Marcus. I worked for the North Face. So I started to have a lot more success in that realm, but it still felt hollow. Mm-hmm. And I knew I had more in me or more I wanted to do. And then I had a few personal things happen. My nephew was born premature and subsequently passed away. And I had a really good girlfriend going through fertility. And I thought, you know, I'm watching these people that I love suffer and not have a lot of resources available to help them navigate it or to help their marriages navigate these major events. And that's when I started exploring, are there options and pathways to become a therapist that don't involve just the clinical psychology PhD pathway? And that's how I found the Family Institute at Northwestern.
Yeah, the personal side of why you made that change seems to be like a major instigator for your career change. And you mentioned sales wasn't for you. Mm-hmm. And you seem very happy being a therapist. And they're both, I mean, you're working with people in different ways. What are some of the common elements and what are the things that are so different that you now love what you do?
I think the biggest stark difference is my experience in sales, and this is purely mine, it was very competitive and it was all about the bottom line. Mm-hmm. And even when I was working for companies I believed in and still believe in to some degree, I don't drink soda anymore, but it just felt really like the only word that I keep coming back to is hollow. Mm-hmm. There was also a little bit, especially with Coca-Cola, and I don't want to be generalizing because they're a very different company now than they were when I was there almost 20 years ago, but it just felt gendered to me too a little bit. And I don't know why that was my experience because there was a female manager that was influential there. And it was all about numbers. And so that's the part that I really found frustrating. I think more of my business experience translated from my retail experience. Like even if I was in sales, there seemed to be more of a human connection. And I think it might be because so much of sales in a retail space depends on the customer feeling good. Mm-hmm. So you
the customer service aspect, totally.
Yeah, exactly.
And so what is so different about therapy that now you have been, how long have you been a therapist?
So I started at the Family Institute in 2012 as a student. So we start seeing clients, we call them, pretty quickly within our programming. They're very strong in helping us navigate what those experiences are like, and they provide a lot of supervision. So I've been working with clients since 2010. So 8 years, probably more like 7 because you really don't build up right away. So
yeah,
7 years, and then I've graduated in 2012. So I've been practicing since 2012.
Yeah. And that the personal connection, it seems like, is what you were really searching for with the therapy. And it sounds like you work with couples who are going through some really tough times. What is it like to develop those relationships with people who are going through such a challenging time in their lives?
It's really incredible. I it's like every day I kind of am in this privileged position of walking with people and their stories and their lives and really helping them hopefully see their worlds differently and helping them navigate unexpected moments in their world. I work a lot with fertility and late-term loss, whether that be second trimester or stillbirth. I do, you know, more run-of-the-mill couples work as well around discernment, which is kind of the decision, do we stay in our marriage, do we not? Do we stay in our relationship, do we not? Affairs, all of those pieces. And then I do quite a bit of individual work as well.
It's so interesting. So you work with some people who are having fertility issues, some couples. Is there bits of advice that you have come up with through your work that you could offer people just something to think about if they're going through, you know, our alumni out there.
I think one of the big universal theme with all couples, whether they're in a distressed place where they're not sure if they want to be together or not, or if they're in this distressed place around more of this, like, what is our world going to look like place, which is more of the fertility, difficult transition to parenthood places. You know, most couples have a process of how they communicate with each other, and we get stuck in one part of the process and we can't let it go and we can't step back and we can't see it differently. And so I think if I had a universal piece of advice is to kind of slow yourselves down and slow the emotional reactivity down and take a step back to allow yourself to possibly stand in your partner's position.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be if you guys are having a hard time achieving parenthood and the path and way you want to have a family, or that would be applicable to if you want to step back and change course with your marriage. I think we're at this cusp where marriage is kind of being redefined. And actually, one of our amazing faculty members here at Northwestern wrote an incredible book called The All or Nothing Marriage from Eli Finkel. And it's one of the books I really appreciate and adore because we're in this new phase of what relationships look like. Mm-hmm. And he does a great job of talking about how marriage has moved from a love-based organization to more of a self-expression. And we're expecting a lot of our partners. And so when partners are able to do that for each other, it looks fantastic. And then like the level of happiness in marriage is really high if you can do it. But if you can't, the level of disappointment is really intense because we're expecting our partners to be our entire extended family, you know, our best friends, our perfect lover. We're, you know, that's a lot to put on one person.
So is that the wrong way of doing things, or is that the new way?
Both. I think it's both, but I would definitely say sitting with a lot of couples, I think I read research recently that we spend significantly less time socializing outside of our marriage and our family than we did in the 70s.
Huh.
And there's also research showing that couples report higher satisfaction levels when they're around and engaged with other couples and people. And so I think a little bit of it is, it still takes a village to bring up kids, and it still takes a village to hold a family together. So don't allow yourselves to be so inwardly focused that you forget to look outward too.
Yeah. And the fact that this is happening when we're in such a connected world now, like you mentioned, you know, this was some of the things that you dealt with were before social media. And now it seems like, oh, you're like one click away from your friends.
Right.
And you feel so connected when you're posting to Facebook. But is that real engagement? Is that real connections?
Exactly. And I think, you know, there's more dual income families out there. And so I think people's bandwidth is really maxed out. And the last thing you want to do is try to figure out how to put socialization in there too. And even prioritizing your partnership can be a challenge. So it feels often like, oh, I'll just get those needs met by scrolling on Facebook.
Right. But that's not
really
how that works.
The needs. Exactly. Exactly.
And I find the dual income challenges that I think you and I had spoken about the first time we met is also just a really intriguing concept now that more couples are both working, and we have some alumni in our Northwestern network who maybe the female is the breadwinner for their family.
Absolutely.
Or making more than their husband.
Mm-hmm.
And are there challenges that you've seen that are common for these couples, or can you talk a little bit more about that?
I think one of the biggest challenges is that we are still in this cultural place where we haven't caught up to what it means to free men and women up from our old siloed roles that we put them in. And so I think oftentimes, especially in female breadwinning households, even if it's female breadwinning where both are contributing, we still haven't gotten to a place where it feels totally comfortable for the men to step into more of that nurturing house management role and for the women to step into the provider role. I think we still have a few constraints around what that means, and frequently shows up in the therapy room as a power imbalance that they're not sure what to do with. They're not coming in overtly because of that, but it's the subversion of kind of identity that they're not sure what it means. And I think as a society and culture, we more globally still don't know what it means. We're past the second wave of feminism, and I would like to believe we're entering the third wave. And what does that mean? I don't think we know yet. We're definitely out educating men at the higher levels. I think I read somewhere that there are now 2 times as many women graduating from vet school as men. It could be a totally wrong statistic on my part, but there are a couple careers that used to be traditionally male-dominated careers that are now female-dominated careers. Yeah. And I don't think we've totally caught up with how we configure our houses and our parenting responsibilities to match that.
So being a therapist, I'm sure a lot of people talk about burnout and self-care because I actually have a social work background where that's all so often they're like, don't get burned out, take care of yourself.
Right.
And I'm wondering if you've had times throughout your many years of providing therapy, if when you've thought, I can't do this anymore, these challenges are too big, or you doubted this career change.
I actually am lucky I have not. I mean, I've definitely felt burnout for sure.
Yeah.
And I have a 3-year-old. So I feel burnout in my ability to balance everything, to be truthful. And I'm doing the bad thing of cutting out. I sit with clients and tell them, you know, make sure you exercise, make sure you eat well. And then I go home and I don't exercise. And so I think in that sense, I'm still trying to figure out the edge between having a leadership role at the Family Institute, being a therapist. I teach once a quarter and I'm coming off of that quarter, being a parent and being a working mom. You know, the old gender piece that I carry around is a lot of guilt that I'm gone most days. I got maybe an hour and a half with my son, maybe, except for the weekends. So trying to sit with that and recognize that he'll be okay, even though I'm not there all the time, is a harder thing to sit with. But it never comes back to like, I shouldn't have picked this career.
It still feels right.
It still feels right. And I've worked really hard in my career to be able to see clients in a time frame that works with my family life. And not a lot of therapists have that luxury. We don't work a 9-to-5 job. So a lot of therapists have to figure out, how do I have this life that doesn't, a career and a life that doesn't fit the normative time frame of when work normally happens.
Mm-hmm.
We have to kind of work when other people aren't working.
Right. And talking about your family, I know the first time we spoke, we talked a little bit about raising kids in this gendered world. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you're strategic about, you know, how you raise your kid now, having the therapy lens you have on relationship, couples therapy, and family issues, and how that's impacted your family.
Absolutely. I'm raising a boy, so I'm raising a white male. So I think there isn't just, you know, he's got dual privilege, and I don't want him to feel shame for that. But I also want him to recognize that he implicitly has power because he's white and he's male. It's hard. I got a lot of pushback. He's got a hyphenated last name, and both of his last names are not super, they don't go well together. So he's got a really clunky, cumbersome, big last name. But it felt important for me, since his father and I weren't married, that my name be attached to him as much as his dad's name. And I'm also working really hard. I'm really mindful of things. And it's hard because my dad's very old school. His dad can skew a little more traditional male. You know, he's 3. I'm not trying to tell him he can't cry. That's an age where boys start to get that message of like, don't cry.
Suck it up.
Exactly. Suck it up. Or, you know, little boys don't do X, or those kind of emotional outputs that I'm trying to allow him to do those things without having the like
stigma. Yeah,
exactly.
One of my biggest questions as someone who doesn't have children, how do you deal with the dilemma of raising your child the way you want to and then putting him into a world that is totally different? And all the kids around him are getting a different message.
Yeah.
And how hard is that?
It's really hard. I live in one of the more affluent suburbs of the Chicagoland area. It's fairly white. It's got a lot of stay-at-home moms. And so I think my son's getting a little bit different messaging than other kids, but I think it's staying true to who I am. Like, I know he's going to have outside influences, and they're going to be different mindsets than mine, but just trying to help him be open-minded to make his own choices and decisions is really a large priority. I think one of the greater challenges is we're parenting in this very child-centered period of time where like everybody feels like they can build the perfect kid. And I think the harder part is that I don't believe that in the work that I do and the research I've read. And I approach parenting a lot more like a gardener, that I only have so much control of what I can do and affect in his world. And I think that's the harder piece. People are like, you don't have him in blah blah activity already? I'm like, he's three. He doesn't need to be in soccer and baseball and all of those things.
Yeah. The child-centered world is also something that I'd love to dive into a little bit, because I feel like so often, well, people my age who are considering having children, it's like, okay, this, we have kids and our lives are over and their lives begin.
Yeah. Everything gets organized around the kid, which is really, you know, as a couples therapist, is one of the worst things you can do for your partnership. Is I'm slightly guilty of it in the sense that, like, yes, I'm not working out because I want to spend more time with my child when I get home, but I also have a career. And I get that it's easy to do that, but I try not to organize my whole entire day around him and what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard because that's part of the messaging out there. Like,
yeah,
this should be in XYZ activities. And if you're not working, you should be totally playing with your kids. And the research doesn't support that. Kids think going to Target with you is quality time. So
I love Target. You know, perfect.
This is going to be great. You don't have to like go to the best park or, you know, do whatever the coolest activity is. It could just be, you know, whatever you're doing to keep your household running can be considered quality time for kids.
Yeah. Still spending time together. Well, Emily, I find the work that you do super interesting, and obviously how it's impacted your life and your personal life is great. But I'd love to talk more about the leadership role that you mentioned earlier at the Family Institute and how you've done so well in your career and kind of risen to this leadership role so quickly. And if you can talk us through the steps you've had starting when you were in school at Northwestern to now being in a leadership role.
Yeah, so I think part of it actually even starts before I went back to graduate school. So I think a lot of it started with my business career. I thought when I started graduate school that I was doing a 180 and I was leaving that part of myself behind. And then after I graduated, I worked for a group practice in the area and was able to see a lot of my retail management background could actually be helpful in organizing and helping with the administrative side of the practice. And then I came back to the Family Institute as staff in a leadership capacity, trying to help really promote their Northbrook location. A lot of people aren't aware that we had a satellite office there. And so I came on in this role of helping market and really lead that office. And then the director of couples services position came open last fall. And I actually didn't think I had enough experience for it, to be honest, you know. So I decided to put my CV in more as a way of showing them, if and when you think I'm ready for this, I'd like to be considered. And lo and behold, I got promoted. So I think a lot of it was I've cultivated relationships with a lot of leadership at the Family Institute prior to coming back on staff as a student. But I think a lot of it's my business background. You know, I didn't totally shed that part of my identity or my career. And that's a lot of my role. It's really looking, you know, I'm leading a team and trying to really help the organization be as healthy as possible so that we can continue to provide services and make sure people know what kind of services we have available.
Yeah. And from when I was getting my master's in social work, I heard a lot that people who were going into therapy, they were going to get promoted into management positions within however long, you know, 5 years down the road, you're probably going to be managing someone. And so often it's such a different skill.
Mm-hmm.
It's therapy versus managing people, which obviously you have this really cool background of business to add to it. But what were some of the challenges and some of the rewarding pieces to becoming a manager and a director?
I think the biggest hurdle was I went from being a team member to in a leadership role. One of my team members and I graduated together. So she and I worked really hard to openly communicate about this change that we had gone from classmate to coworkers to now I'm her director. Mm-hmm. And what does that all look like? That was probably one of the hardest roles. And then I have some of the most senior clinicians at the Family Institute that come into my team, and so really balancing that they don't need me to lead them, they actually led the organization for a very long time, that I can use them more in a mentorship capacity of where they are at their stage in their career and where I am in the stage of my career, and how together we can all help the Family Institute provide the best level of care that we can to our clients and our community too. So that, I think, was a really unique challenge. I've never led such senior people before. Mm-hmm. Even in the retail world, it always felt like I was leading people developmentally in my stage or coming up behind me developmentally. So to leave mm-hmm. people so like way far out that are way developmentally ahead of me that I've admired for years was a really interesting challenge.
Yeah. And the fact that you have such different relationships with mm-hmm. the people you manage. You have some people who I'm sure you're leading more and some Correct. People who you look to for mentorship. And I love the experiential learning aspect to your Northwestern experience. And I'd love to talk a little bit more about how that has impacted. Obviously, you know, you went on to then work at Northwestern.
And so I came back.
It never ended. But if you can talk a little bit about how that experience has shaped your career and your life.
Yeah. The Family Institute was such a huge part of my graduate school experience. And for the people listening, the Family Institute's nested into Northwestern. We are the Center for Applied Psychological Studies at Northwestern. And so we're a research and education component of Northwestern, but we're a separate nonprofit entity from the university. So we're like part of it, but also not totally part of it. So that piece was always great, both as a student and now as staff, that we're intertwined, but we're also a slight bit separate too. Mm-hmm. So I got both the student piece of being a Northwestern student, but the Family Institute has such a rich layer of staff and professors and faculty. And so that experience always really informed me in the mentorship capacity. And then between the two, both Northwestern and the Family Institute, they really network hard with their alumni. And so it always felt seamless and interconnected.
Yeah, that's great. The Northwestern network is so vast.
Exactly. Very connected. I don't feel like being part of the University of Michigan's too, and this isn't a knock on Michigan because it has amazing things, but I never felt totally included in it mm-hmm. versus Northwestern makes you feel very included. And I don't know if that's a product of grad school versus undergrad school, but it feels very different.
Yeah, the Northwestern network is such a great network to tap into and to go back to throughout one's career. Emily, you're teaching as well. Is that?
I'm more of a teaching assistant this year. So
you're doing so much. You're a director, yeah. You're doing therapy, you're teaching.
My direct boss, the chief clinical officer at the Family Institute, taught one of my favorite classes during graduate school. And this past year, she invited me to co-instruct with her. Cool. So this year, I was more of truly like a TA and just mm-hmm. in complete awe of her again. And then hopefully the goal is that I'll help lecture and grade. And that's been a huge part of coming back as well. I mean, a large part of why I came back was the ability to research, the ability to write, the ability to teach, to have a much broader career than just being clinically involved with clients.
Yeah, and your career is so broad now. Yeah. You're doing so much, which
Maybe
is great.
Too broad.
What are some of the things you're most proud of in your career looking back?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I'm definitely proud of the clinical work I do. That feels like a really big privilege, and it's something that I recognize there, you know, as therapists, a lot of people never retire. You just slowly build your caseload down till it feels manageable. And then
you never actually retire.
Like it's hard. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like it's hard to actually retire as a therapist from at least a lot of the mentors I see out there. And that feels important to me. And so I'm glad I made that shift. But I think maybe what I'm most proud of is to be able to take all of that previous career experience and intertwine it with the direction that I felt strongly about going and mm-hmm. making a career out of both of them, not having to throw away my earlier careers.
Yeah, that's great. And turning the tables a little bit, are there any learning lessons or career missteps that you've had along the way that had a really big impact on how you've gotten to where you are now?
The therapist part in me is going to say I'm a big proponent of failure-driven learning. So I think trying sales and trying it as hard as I did early in my career, if I hadn't made those mistakes, I wouldn't have gotten to where I was. I actually got fired from an ad agency. I think it was 2003 or 4. They had hired me on as their new business development, which is pretty much lingo for cold calling sales. And I was really, again, bad at sales. And it became very alarmingly obvious when I wasn't supported by a large organization like Viacom or Coca-Cola mm-hmm. that I really wasn't good at it. And at the time, I would have probably said that was devastating, but that's what got me on the trajectory of really having a successful business career mm-hmm. and then opened up space to lead me back to grad school too. So I wouldn't say it was a mistake necessarily, but that was the moment that I was at my lowest career-wise. Like getting fired was a horrible feeling.
Yeah, I've talked to a lot of successful alumni thus far in creating this podcast, and almost every one of them has a story of being fired.
Yes,
and that being like a moment where you're like, reevaluate.
It's an identity moment too. I mean, because it happened right at developmentally the same age where like I had 7 or 8 weddings. Within like the 6 months after I got fired. So I was single. I had just gotten fired. Here are all my peers taking all these life steps.
Yeah.
And again, I graduated from Michigan. So some of my peers from Michigan were doing some really intensely cool things. So I kind of felt like, oh, well, I'm failing at all of this. And a lot of my clients who have been fired say the same thing. There's this like identity moment of, do I have value? Like so much of our lives are professionally oriented.
Yeah. The identity of who am I now? That I don't have my job, because isn't that like baby boomers or Gen Xers, just when they introduce themselves, they're like, hi, I'm so-and-so, I'm a lawyer.
Right.
They define themselves by what they do.
Yeah.
And so glad you share that, because I think so many people in the Northwestern Network have that type of experience, or people listening in are going through that right now.
Right.
And there is a light at the end of the tunnel. You'll find what is best for you. Maybe this is
probably even better for you.
Exactly.
Clearly wasn't a good fit. I shouldn't say that. In my case, it was me. I probably deserved to be fired.
No, there are different ways to be fired, definitely. But that's really helpful for the Northwestern Network. And have you received any advice throughout your career in these different positions that's really stuck with you from one job to the next?
I had a really great manager at the North Face, and I think working for them as an organization was a pretty defining moment overall. Just they are a fiscally sound company that's also ethically and environmentally trying their best with the constraints of being who they are. But I had a manager who told me, you're only as good as the weakest person on your team. And so don't make it about you. Make it about the people underneath you. That was a shift for me in management that helped me step back from micromanaging and helped me recognize how incredibly important delegating was and letting things go in order to be a leader. It helped me recontextualize leadership.
I love that that's the bit of advice that you have to offer too, from being a therapist who works with one-on-one with people, to have this team aspect that's really influenced you.
Yeah.
And now I'd love to get into our speed round.
Okay.
Of really random questions that we just want you to answer as quickly as you can. First thing that comes to mind. In another life, what would you want to do or be?
A chef.
That's awesome. What are some of the restaurants that have really inspired you in Chicago?
Well, my favorite is Avec, and has been for years.
Where is that?
They're on Randolph, on the eastern edge of all the cool spots. And they were over there well before all the cool spots came into play. I haven't been there in a while. I know they've had executive chef changes since the last time I've been there, but such a cool space, and just they've always been very innovative. And then definitely Alinea. I mean, I've never had wine and food match in such a profound way before.
I'm so jealous.
I mean, it's just so cool.
Yeah. And to be a foodie in Chicago, it's a great place.
They always, you know, stop and show you the kitchen and everything, I think, or at least that's what they did when I was there. So it's Grant, I love you.
That's awesome. No, you can be a chef next to him in your future life. And what is the funniest thing that has happened to you recently?
Oh, recently. I don't know. I lead a pretty boring life. I'm trying to
think. Well, your 3-year-old, I'm
well,
sure.
That's true. I know. My son, I'm not Irish, but my son's part Irish from his father's side. And St. Patrick's Day, he insisted on wearing his underwear on his head all day. He like seemed like a drunk Irishman. Like he had his little like Irish shirt. I'm like, you're not even drinking yet. And you're already like crazy on St. Patrick's Day. Like
he just feels it. He senses his Irish roots.
Your Irish Chicago is like showing up in you, buddy.
Oh, that is a good one. And if someone gave you $1 million grant right now to use on something that makes the world better, how would you use that money?
Probably to research the impact of relationships on mental health and families. There isn't enough research money getting funneled to that, to be honest. There's a little bit in the military, but because of the nature of the complexity of researching multiple people in the room, especially clinically, is really challenging.
Yeah.
And so most clinical psychology programs focus on an individual pathology. And we do know from research that the relationships around us impact all of those things. I would probably put it in that direction.
Yeah, that's great. And tell me about your favorite time or place when you ran into a fellow Northwestern alumnus, which is probably every day.
Yeah.
Your favorite
it's every day that I go to work.
I know. I was going to say, does it ever happen when you're not on campus or at work?
Occasionally. I mean, a lot of times it happens at work because one of our alumni has a practice two doors down and a lot of my cohort works. So we're all kind of around each other.
Oh, that's funny. And if you could be any animal in the world, what animal would you be and why?
Probably a dog. They are the most attuned to humans and they're most attuned to connect. There's a lot of research showing that they have a larger capacity to read our nonverbal feedback than we do.
Huh.
Yeah, they're more attuned to us than we are to ourselves.
Crazy. Yeah. What kind of dog would you be?
Well, my dog that died in December was a basset hound, so I have a high affinity for bassets. Although, as he was dying, I found out that I'm allergic to dogs, so I will not be able to have another basset hound.
So you figured that out after you had a dog for years?
I had had him for 17. He died 17 and a half. So
17 and a half years.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
my gosh. So, and you were allergic that whole time?
I'm only mildly allergic, but towards the end, I think, because he was having a lot of issues. I think it exacerbated all my allergies, but
yeah. Well, there are hypoallergenic dogs.
Yeah, or
right?
Like less allergen.
Yes, yes.
Bassets are not one of them.
Yeah. And what do you wish you could tell yourself as you graduated from Northwestern, now knowing what you know about your career?
I think I needed less advice when I graduated from Northwestern. I was older and more mature than I did when I was graduating from Michigan. But both ages and stages, I probably would have told myself to just be more comfortable in the moment, to be more present in the here and now.
So hard.
The future doesn't matter as much as you feel or think it should.
It's definitely something that has always been a challenge for me, especially like learning how to do these interviews, be present.
I think for most people.
Yeah. That's great. And do you have any other advice, general career path advice for the Northwestern Network as a whole?
Probably the same, because I think a lot of us that come to Northwestern are high achievers and very future driven. Think about my experience. I frequently went over to Kellogg to get, they have better food options than a lot of places on campus, and watching a lot of the Kellogg students. And I think it's just to be in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Don't spend your life chasing something. Be present with what's here and now.
That's great. Very simple, yet could be transformational if you actually attempt and try to do that.
Right. And I recognize it's hard to do.
Yeah, yeah. And have that self-awareness. That's awesome. And Emily, thank you so much for spending this time with us and for being here, sharing all these great insights.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of Northwestern Intersections. To find more information about the podcast, please visit northwestern.edu/intersections. That is northwestern.edu/intersections. Have a great rest of your day and go Cats!